Welcome. The title of my talk today is Empowerment or Manipulation. What is your preferred method? Empowerment or manipulation? How do you interact with people? Do you build them up? Or do you tear them down? Or do you do a little bit of both? Do you manipulate them? Or do you empower them? That's the choice. So, we know, because we've talked about this many times, we have the ego. Prabhupada always referred to it as the false ego. And we have the Atma, the soul, the self, the true identity. When we're acting out of ego, self-interest, we are more likely to want to control or manipulate or take advantage of others. When we're acting above and beyond the ego as the true self, then we are far less likely to want to manipulate and control others. Makes sense? So, ego is personal benefit. It is material in nature, connected to matter. And self or soul is spiritual in nature, and it acts for the greater good. Not ego is personal interest, and Atma or soul is the interest of everyone. And that actually simply, these are symptoms of a self-realized soul. The more self-realized you become, the less self-interested you become, those qualities will automatically develop in you. It's not like you have to work on them separately. They will come as a consequence of your consciousness being raised. So, criticism. Criticism is very important. Constructive criticism, absolutely essential. How can you improve anything without looking at it in a constructive manner, criticizing it, looking at the pluses and the minuses, and improving? Right? Do you not do that with your children? That's what we do with children, don't we? Do you do that with your employees? Those of you who have businesses? You do that sometimes with your friends to help them out? Of course you do. Do you do it with yourself? Ooh, there's a concept. As opposed to what? As opposed to destructive criticism. Destructive criticism tears down. Constructive criticism builds up. I've been doing, as some of you know, I've been doing Vedic astrology now for 40 years. It's my 40th year. I have clients in 52 countries around the world. And one of the most common things that I have found with people, because I know all of their intimate stuff, they tell me. I don't even have to ask, and they tell me, is the self-criticism. They're too hard on themselves. You're too hard on yourself. There's two forces in the universe, expansion, contraction. We've talked about this. You don't believe me? Watch your lungs for a couple minutes. Constructive criticism does what? It expands what? The channel. So that the energy can flow. Destructive criticism does what? It narrows the channel. It chokes the channel. We're humans. We're here to what? To grow. Just like plants, just like the animals, we're all here to grow, to evolve, to improve, especially humans. So we have consciousness, and we're sentient beings. We have a brain. So it is incumbent upon you to also use constructive criticism toward yourself. It's very important. There are only two things you can do with your words. Generally, you can bless or you can curse. What does blessing do? It expands. What does cursing do? It contracts. And by blessing others, they will thrive and prosper. And you yourself will be blessed. How do I know that? Because what goes around comes around, correct? Isn't it? You may not know how you will be blessed. You may not be conscious of when it happens in your life or from whom it comes. But it will come, assuredly. By cursing others, they may meet with difficulty or reversal in their lives, depending how serious your curse is, depending how much power is behind it, depending how much anger and animosity is behind it. What's the most famous curse that we say in English? Go to hell. I'm not going to look at anybody when I say that. I'm looking at the wall. That's what we say, among other things. Right? So, you can also, by cursing, attract negative reaction to yourself. That will come from some direction at some point in time. We don't want to curse. It's not always easy, especially when they just cut you off on the highway or some such thing. Better to bite your tongue. Now, this concept I've talked about many times. I want to include it in this talk. There are only three roles you can have in life. Victim, victimizer, and victor. That's it, my friends. That's all that's available. 95% of the world is made up of what? Victims and victimizers. It's a big V. You can't have a victim without a victimizer. You can't have a victimizer without a victim. And then I say, open the newspaper. If you don't believe me, it's full of victims and victimizers. Is it not? The victor is what we want to become, which happens to be the minority of people in the world. Now, the 95%, I just pulled that out of the ethers. I don't know if it's 95%. I know it's the vast majority. Why? Because I sit there and talk to people all day long around the world, and I hear the stories of their victimization. But I also hear the stories of sometimes they're doing the victimizing and also the victor. This is what we want to aspire to. The victor victimizes no one and is victimized by no one. That is the win-win situation. That's where you need to get to if you're not already there. I would suggest that most of you here would not be victimizers and certainly would not want consciously to be victimizers. Maybe you used to be. Maybe it's a work in progress. Great. But we don't want to victimize. Is it good then? Would it be better to be a victim? No. You wouldn't be. Don't be either. There's a statement in the Vedas that says, plotting and scheming in order to bring others under your control or under your manipulation results in your own mental imbalance. Does that sound reasonable? I think it would be very, very reasonable if that's what you do full time. There are people who are constantly plotting and scheming. You know one or two of them, right? Try to take advantage of people or circumstances. I thought I would mention this. I read this in a book called Evidence of the Afterlife, which has it contains what happened to many people who died and came back. The near-death experience. They were dead, they were thought dead, pronounced dead, and resurrected themselves. Same body, not different body. It's the story of this woman who had a near-death experience in which she could see everything that had happened throughout her lifetime. Because your lifetime passes before you. I had this experience when I was 21. I saw my whole lifetime flash before me. Before I was brought round. And yeah, you do. You see it. She could understand all the events of her life with the clarity and super lucidity that she had never experienced before. Why? Because she was beyond this realm. She was in a higher realm of perception. She realized that she herself had chosen to take on a physical body. In other words, she realized she participated in the whole process. It didn't just happen to her, and go through the various experiences she had had in her life. She then realized that she had wasted her time in suffering. Ooh, big revelation. And that she should have been using her free will to choose true love and not pain and suffering throughout her life. So she had assumed the role of the victim in her life. And when she had her near death, she could see that it was her choice. And all the while, victims believe, oh, poor me. This happened to me, that happened to me, and so-and-so said this, and so-and-so did that. Is that not true? Did those things not happen? Yeah. They happened. But we also say sometimes we create our own reality. The mind creates its reality. That's why the mind is extremely important. Because your state of mind will determine your reality coupled with your karma from your past life. We're not trying to say that karma has no effect. Of course it does. But the more you raise your state of mind and your consciousness, the less you are going to be the victim or feel like life is treating you badly. It's all so unfair. You know? Yeah, well, if you believe it's unfair, it will probably continue to be so. Anyway, I'll leave you with that one to think about. A person of higher consciousness, or a leader, a true leader of higher consciousness, learns to emulate the five elements of nature. What are the five elements of nature? Material nature, physical nature. Earth, water, fire, air, and ether, space. Earth, like the earth, he provides fertile ground for all those around him and encourages their growth and development. This includes you, not just those around you. But I've written this down as though it's a leader. Water. Like water, he quenches the thirst for those seeking love and understanding. Water represents emotion. Fire. Like fire, he shines brightly, offering enlightenment and inspiring dynamic action all around him. Do you shine for people? Do you shine, or you walk around in a cloud, or worse, in a haze? It's your job to shine. And offer enlightenment. What does the sun do? As I say to people, they go into a sun major period in their astrology chart in their life. It's okay, you know what you're supposed to do now, don't you? No, what? One thing only. Shine. What does the sun do? Does one thing only, my friends. It shines. It's real simple. Sun, we're in a complex cosmos, and the sun simply shines. He's broken it down to its most fundamental action. And everybody loves it. Except in Equatorial Guinea, where it's too hot. Right? And inspiring dynamic action. Do you inspire dynamic action all around you? Or do you not want to get out of bed in the morning? I don't want to get out of bed this morning. It's too cold. You must inspire dynamic action in you and in those around you. Is your life just okay? Is your life an inspiration? Or you just bring everybody down? It's a choice. We call it free will. What a concept. Sometimes people think, oh, your karma, it's all going to fall on your head, there's nothing you can do. Oh, you know. No. Free will. You have choices. You can choose to grow or not grow. Wind. Like the wind, it clears the air of confusion and makes his breath the vehicle for words of truth. Makes his breath the vehicle for words of truth. Wonderful. That lovely concept. When Prabhupada was here, and I was with Prabhupada many, many times, as I'm sure you were. Yeah, and we heard him speak. Sometimes just casually he'd sit and have a little darshan, or sometimes on morning walks along the beach, or in a park, sometimes formal interviews. But when he gave class, that was the best. I loved it when he gave class. Other devotees, then, his disciples would also speak. Sometimes Prabhupada would ask them to speak. They would say the philosophy exact same. They would repeat what they learned. But Prabhupada's words were suffused with prana, with life force. And he was connected directly to Krishna. So when somebody is on that level of realization, a lot of words come through them. They're not their own words, they just come out. And they shift lives. Prabhupada's words shifted lives. If you and I sit down and watch TV and we watch a documentary, and it's a very good documentary, and at the end we look at each other and go, oh, that was good, right? That was informative. Will it change your life? Probably not. Because the breath must be the vehicle for truth. I'm not saying what they were saying isn't true. It's, can you shift consciousness with it? That's what Prabhupada did all the time, day in and day out. Last element, Akash, space, ether. Like space, he provides a place for everything. You need space because things need a place to go. Like space, he provides a place for everything, yet he's attached to nothing. Everything belongs to Krishna. Isha vasyam idam sarvam yat kincha jagatyang jagat. Everything is controlled and owned by the Lord. It's there for you. Whatever is your quota, it's there for you. You can have it. You can enjoy it. You can utilize it. You can share it. You can give it. Give it away. But you can't be attached to it. You can't be overly identified with it. You want to drive a Mercedes-Benz because you think it's a good car? Yes, you'll have to appreciate the German cars. They are well made. You can drive a Mercedes-Benz, no problem. But you can't identify with it. Look at me, I'm driving a Mercedes-Benz. No. Now your ego is invested in it. You can have anything as long as your ego is not invested in it, as long as you're not caught up in it. And if today you have your Mercedes-Benz and tomorrow you don't, okay. Doesn't matter. Doesn't affect you. All right. Now, let's go to the Vedas directly and find out who the master of empowerment is, and touch on some of the characters who use manipulation as their methodology as opposed to those who use empowerment. Well, in the Mahabharata, Duryodhana, the antagonist in the story, the Pandavas, the five brothers, were the protagonists, and the Kauravas, headed by Duryodhana, were the antagonists, so-called bad guys. Duryodhana, of course, was not due to take the throne, because his father was not given the throne because his father was born blind, Dhritarashtra. So the Pandavas, they were to take the throne. And Duryodhana was, by nature, a very envious character. Very envious. In fact, Duryodhana was an incarnation of whom? Kali. You know, we've talked about many times Kali Yuga. This is the universal time we're in, the epoch, the era that we are currently in. Kali Yuga, the age of quarrel, corruption, hypocrisy, conflict. So Kali brings everything down. So that was Duryodhana. He was actually an incarnation of Kali. So he tried to, because Bhima, one of the Pandavas, was very strong, and he would play pranks on the Kaurava brothers. Maybe too many pranks, I don't know, but he was pretty busy giving them a hard time, and they couldn't defeat him. So Duryodhana tried to poison Bhima twice with the Kalakuta poison. Then he decided, and since Bhima was not able to be killed off, then he had a palace built for the Pandavas, a beautiful palace, but he had it built out of resin, lac. It was disguised. And then when he convinced them to go there and spend some time there, with their mother, no less, he had it burned down in an effort to kill them all. It didn't work. They escaped through a secret tunnel. And then when a little bit later in the story, Yudhishthira, who was the head of the Pandavas, the oldest brother, and was the one who actually took the throne, they cheated him in a dice game. Why is he playing a dice game? Because Kshatriyas, warriors, leaders, these kinds of persons, if they're challenged, the code was you accept a challenge, whatever it is, back in those days. And they had their uncle Shakuni to actually play dice, and he was like a card sharp nowadays. He knew how to cheat. So they were cheated in the game. In fact, twice they played. So in that game, they lost their entire kingdom. They lost their entire kingdom, and then they were driven into exile for 12 years in the forest, wandering around in the forest. And an extra year incognito, where they had to remain incognito. And if they were recognized, they'd have to go into the forest for another 12 years. And the whole thing was based on cheating. Anyway, that's what Duryodhana did. So his methodology was manipulation. Then we come to Krishna and Arjuna. The Bhagavad Gita, which is part of the Mahabharata, is the story of the beginning, just right before this great battle, which inevitably came between the Kauravas and the Pandavas. And Krishna, God himself, agreed to drive the chariot of Arjuna. He says, I will not fight. I will not use weapons. On your behalf, I will drive your chariot, simply. And Duryodhana got a 1 million man army from Krishna. He got the army, and Arjuna got Krishna to drive his chariot without weapons. So Duryodhana thought, I must have died and gone to heaven because I got the million man army. I'm the lucky guy here. Now, we know from the pastimes of Krishna in the Srimad Bhagavatam, Krishna Leela, his pastimes on earth 5,000 years ago. Even as a baby, Krishna was attacked by many powerful demons who wanted him gone. No one could overpower him. He killed many demons single-handedly, as did his brother Balaram. So he could actually, because his incarnation, the purpose of it, was to remove the negative energy from the planet, the negative persons, the demoniac energies, forces, get them off the planet. Mother Earth had come and pleaded and said, I'm overburdened with all this negativity and all these negative people who are manipulative and self-serving. Please, please come and do something. And that's why he came. When God comes and takes an incarnation down here on earth, it isn't always known when and how he will appear. It isn't always known. Sometimes he just appears and people have to figure it out. He doesn't always have fanfare and announcement. That's an important thing to remember. So he could have destroyed the Kauravas on the battlefield single-handedly because he had destroyed these demons even in his youth and childhood. But he didn't. Arjuna was the brother of Yudhishthira, and Arjuna was the foremost warrior on the planet, well, archer in particular. And Arjuna was Krishna's close friend, his confidant, and in fact, his brother-in-law. So Arjuna, of course, when he saw who was arrayed against them on the battlefield, he decided he didn't want to fight, because on the other side were his relatives, his kinsmen, his grandfather, his military teacher, his guru, and many, many other personalities that he knew personally and had known since he was a child. So he said, I can't do it. I don't want to fight. But he's a Kshatriya, and a Kshatriya is a warrior, not just about making war. It's about being able to take up arms and defend the people. That's what warriors are supposed to do. Modern day, we have armed forces, we have the police, we have the fire brigade, fire department, we have search and rescue people, we have the Coast Guard. That's what all these people are for. They put themselves at risk for us, for strangers, for the people. It takes courage. And, it's a noble thing to do, especially if you're doing it without corruption. So that was Arjuna's duty. It was his duty. It was his obligation to do this. And he said, no, I can't do it. Dropped his bow. God put his head down. Said, Krishna, I can't fight. So he didn't have the will or the stomach for the task. So why did Krishna then instruct Arjuna? Why didn't Krishna just go ahead and do it himself? Because Krishna wants you to do your duty. He wants you to make war? No. If you're a policeman or you're in the armed forces, maybe he wants you to take risks with weaponry. He wants us as individuals to act in accord with our own fundamental nature, to do our duty. To do our duty even when we don't want to. When it's not convenient. When it's too cold in the morning and I don't want to get out of bed. When I have a boss that I don't like. When I'm stuck in a traffic jam. Make your list. We do our duty. So this is what Krishna was illustrating to Arjuna. This is our metaphor. This is the greatest metaphor, the Bhagavad Gita, from the point of view of Dharma and the execution of Dharma, how to do your duty. What were Arjuna's objections to fighting? Number one, killing his relatives on the battlefield. Number two, he argued, and these are reasonable arguments, my friends. These arguments are not unreasonable. Number two, he argued, this will cause the destruction of the dynasty and the family tradition. That's what's going to happen if we do this. And the next one, women, because their men are killed, women are supposed to be, according to Vedic understanding, they're supposed to be protected. They're supposed to be respected and protected and looked after. I talk to people literally all day long about what? Relationships. And every single woman I have met, and I've met thousands of them, in relationship, let me tell you what she wants. Gentlemen, in case this is a news flash for you, she wants to be loved, respected, regarded, protected, and made to feel like a woman. Every woman I know. Is this my idea? No. This is how we're made. This is how women are wired. There you go. That's what they want in relationship. And if they have that, they're generally pretty happy. All right? So Arjuna is arguing, if they lose their protectors, their husbands, their fathers, whomever, who will look after them? When women don't have protectors, now I'm not trying to take away your freedom, ladies, so don't start throwing balls of paper at me yet. If women are not respected and protected, then what happens? Men who are not moral or not honest or are manipulative in nature will do what? They will take advantage. They will take advantage. I was talking to this lady the other day and I said to her, she says, well, he was like this and he was so wonderful and, you know, and then, you know, we got into relationship and it just changed. I said, oh yeah, you're the chameleon. Men will tell you anything you want to hear. How do I know? I'm a man. Whatever you want. Oh yeah, oh, I love that too. Let's go do that. Okay. At the beginning. Until, oh, got her now. Now I can become who I really am. I'm free. Anybody experience that here, ladies? One, two. That's pretty good. Out of these 15,000 people, three. That was a man who put up his hand that time. See? Even men are cruel to men. I know. There's a lot. Okay? So, that's not how we treat women. So, Arjun's argument was that they will not have protection. And then men will take advantage of them. And then we will get unwanted population. Varna Sankar. Unwanted population. Women get pregnant. Correct? Do we see any of that nowadays? It is rampant, my friends. There are people who just have babies. There are women who just have babies from different men because, you know, the dole payment gets bigger each time. I am not exaggerating. It's true. Some do. Okay, so the women will become degraded and the result is Varna Sankar or unwanted population. And the last reason he gave was he was grief-stricken. He didn't want to have to do it. Okay? So then Krishna said, this is Krishna doing what? On behalf of Arjuna. Empowering Arjuna. That's what we said. What is your method? Empowerment or manipulation? That is the title of this talk. Krishna now begins the process of empowering Arjuna. When Arjuna is at his lowest possible point. What does he say? While speaking learned words, you are mourning for what is not worthy of grief. Those who are wise lament neither for the living nor the dead. So there's a difference between the spirit and the body. And he clearly points that out. Considering your specific duty as a Kshatriya, as a warrior, you should know there is no better engagement for you than fighting based on dharma. Doing your duty based on dharma, on virtue, on principle, on higher purpose. That's why you do your duty. So, for Kshatriyas to act in harmony with their dharma, there's nothing better than fighting on religious principles, and so there is no need for hesitation. If a person, a warrior, is sacrificing their life on a battlefield or wherever, even a policeman on the street, sacrificing his life in a shootout or some such thing, right, on behalf of somebody else, and he gets killed, the warrior gets killed, what happens to that soul? Do you know? That soul goes straight to the heavenly planets. He does not necessarily go to the spiritual world. He goes to the heavenly planets because that is considered to be the highest sacrifice for a warrior. Those who get killed trying to save, rescue, or protect others go immediately to the heavenly planets for a very long period of time, depending. Okay. Krishna continues, O Partha, happy are the Kshatriyas to whom such fighting opportunities come unsought, opening for them the doors to the heavenly planets. That's what he says. If, however, you do not perform your religious duty of fighting, then you will certainly incur sins for neglecting your duties and thus lose your reputation as a fighter. Oh. So, incur sin means what? To incur some negative reaction. Because you didn't do your duty. You didn't do what you came here to do. And he could argue, well, I didn't kill anybody, so therefore there's no negative reaction. No, you didn't do, yeah, that's true. But you didn't do your duty. So that too can create negative reaction, can result in negative reaction. People will always speak of your infamy, and for a respectable person, dishonor is worse than death. For one who has been honored, dishonor is worse than death. We all try, I think we can agree, you're free to disagree. We all try to be respectable and respected people, do we not? Don't all of us by nature want a good reputation? Don't we want to be thought of well by others? What others? Well, pretty much everybody. Of course, we can't please everybody. It doesn't work like that. But we like, for the most part, that people will look upon us favorably and not unfavorably. And people who lose their honor or somehow, especially if they're dishonored and they're not guilty, then what? So to maintain your honor, it says also in the Vedas that for an honorable person, when they die, their reputation lives on long after they die. Is that true? Yes, it's true. Historical figures, writers, some political figures, spiritual people. Well, look at Prabhupada, you know. Prabhupada's been gone quite a long time now, and his reputation, in my opinion, is probably better than ever, you know, in the scheme of things. So, yeah, it's very important. Then Krishna continues, the great generals who have highly esteemed your name, now these are the generals, and these are your people here. You're a warrior. You're highly respected among your people. If you're a craftsperson, you know, you appreciate the fact that somebody loves your beautiful woodwork. Your customers or, you know, other people. But it is the greatest compliment when other craftspeople compliment you, because they are in the same field, same business, and they understand exactly what it takes to do this. So here's Arjuna with the generals. The great generals who have highly esteemed your name and fame will think that you have left the battlefield out of what? Fear. Oh, he's turned and run. The most famous guy on the battlefield has turned tail. He's run.
We scared him, didn't we?
Right? That's what they think. Well, wouldn't you think that? Of course you would. When we were little kids, we'd say that. We're on the playground. He's afraid. Doesn't change. Okay. And thus, they will consider you to be nothing but insignificant. Then he continues, your enemies will describe you in many unkind words and scorn your ability. What could be more painful for you than that? For a person who has been glorified and esteemed, that is the most painful thing. Look at all these. Let's see what's happening now with this sex scandal thing. That's all of these powerful men in various walks of life, have been exposed for all this predatory behavior toward women. And some of them, I mean, the lists of these women is so long, it's unimaginable. One of them, I won't even mention his name, he's had famous actresses because he's a producer. And he's had so many of these actresses, I don't know in which way, but in ways that these women did not want. And he came home and the press is gathered outside of his house. And they're questioning him. And he goes, come on, fellas. Hang on now. A guy deserves a second chance. A second chance. How many women did he prey upon? I mean, it's absurd. He thinks he deserves a second chance. He's had chance number 63 already. And he's still continuing. Then Krishna says, O son of Kunti, either you will be killed on the battlefield and attain the heavenly planets, or you will conquer and enjoy the earthly kingdom. That's what's going to happen. So the kingdom, the entire earth, the Pandavas actually were Chakravartis. Yudhishthira was a Chakravarti. Chakravarti is not a king. It's an emperor whom all the other kings bow to. And they had, I won't get into all this right now, but they have a way of, they send around this horse and they have a way of determining which kings will accept them as being the emperor and which ones won't. That's how they went about it. And until everybody would accept that this is the main guy now. So then Krishna says, therefore, having said all this, get up with determination, pull yourself together, my words, and fight. Do what you've come here to do. Do thou fight for the sake of fighting, without considering happiness or distress, loss or gain, victory or defeat. And by so doing, you shall never incur sin. Incur what? Negative reaction. Do your duty, no matter what. And don't be attached to the outcome. Do the best job you can do. When? All the time. In what? In whatever you do. You may have a job sweeping floors. And you may say, I don't really like this job. But you have to understand there's a universal principle. You do that job the best you can do, it causes you to grow and expand into a better job and a better opportunity. That's how it works. When you do a thing neglectfully and haphazardly without being conscientious, and you walk around muttering like we talked about earlier, and you're just hoping for a new opportunity, how are you creating a new opportunity for yourself when you're doing a crap job of the thing you're doing at the moment? Who wants you? The universe sees it. Believe me. Everything you do, my friends, must be done, as Prabhupada would always say, first class. First class. That's how he said it. Everything needs to be done first class. Even no one sees it, it doesn't matter. You still do it. Because it creates a mindset. It creates a reality. It creates a reaction out in the world. It creates a ripple. And when a ripple goes out to the middle of the pond, what happens? It comes back. And there you are. Ready. Because you do everything to the best of your ability. That's what a person of higher consciousness does. Then, to conclude, 18th chapter, what does Krishna say? Did he browbeat Arjuna? Was he browbeating him? No. Did he call him names? No. He simply told him the truth. Did he not? Then what did he say? Right at the end of the Bhagavad Gita. I was saying, this was second chapter. All those verses were mostly from the second chapter. Now we're on the 18th chapter. And all in between, he explained everything and the entire system of yoga. Every system there is union with God. And don't forget, this is God, Krishna. And so Krishna concludes, he says, thus I've explained to you knowledge still more confidential. Here's the line. Here's the line. Deliberate on this fully, and then do what you wish to do. Did he intimidate him? Did he put him down? Did he give him destructive criticism? Did he give him constructive criticism? What did he give him? Did he give him no choice? Or did he give him a choice at the end? Deliberate on everything I've said to you and make your decision. I leave it with you. That's what you do. When you give people advice, when they come to you with a problem, you tell them what you think. You give them the best advice you can. And suppose they say, yeah, I don't want to do that. I'm going to do this. And then you simply say, oh, that's fine. You can do that if you want. But this will be the result. Tell them what that result will be if they take the wrong course of action. Tell them. Don't tell them angrily. Just tell them. Did Krishna get angry in the Bhagavad Gita? Tell me where he got angry. In all those words, where did he get angry and upset? He didn't. You know, he's going, oh, are you kidding me, man, Arjuna? You're making me crazy. He didn't say any of that. Because you are my very dear friend, I'm speaking to you my supreme instruction, the most confidential knowledge of all. Please listen, for it is for your benefit. Always think of me. Now, this is God speaking, and don't forget. Always think of me, become my devotee, worship me, and offer your homage unto me. Thus you will come to me without fail. I promise you this. I promise. He's talking to you, my friend. I promise you this because you are my very dear friend. You mean to say God's got no friends? Oh no, he's got friends. Why would he want me? Why would he want you as his friend? He does. He does. We're his peeps. He wants us. He's waiting. Abandon all varieties of dharma, of religion, all beliefs, all methodologies. Forget it. Well, just forget about all that. And surrender. Surrender to me. Why? Why would I do that? I will look after you. I'll deliver you from all negative reaction. Don't worry. Don't worry. I'll look after you. So what did Arjuna say then? My dear Krishna, O infallible one, my illusion is now gone. That haze you had earlier, the haze is gone. My illusion is now gone. By your mercy, I have regained my memory. By your mercy, I am now firm and free from doubt and prepared to act according to your instructions, according to your recommendations. And then the capper, wherever there is Krishna, the master of all mystics, wherever there is Arjuna, the supreme archer, there will also certainly be opulence, victory, extraordinary power, and morality. So how do you fit into that last statement? You put yourself in Arjuna's place. That's how. Do you have to get up on a chariot and take up your bow and arrows? Not exactly. You do metaphorically. Yes, you do. So back to empowerment versus manipulation. What did Krishna do here? He empowered him. What did Arjuna do? He went and fought the battle. What happened? He won. Was anybody killed? Oh yeah. Lots of people. And finally at the end, Arjuna said, thank you, Krishna, for driving my chariot. We're done. We've won. We've won a victory. Please get down off the chariot now, Krishna. Thank you for driving my chariot. Krishna said, you get down first. Really? Please, you get down, Arjuna. Arjuna got off the chariot. Krishna got off the chariot a moment later, and the whole chariot went up in flames and came down in ashes. The horses, the chariot, the armaments, everything. The flag of Hanuman, ashes. Arjuna was stunned. What just happened? Krishna said, I told you I wouldn't fight, and I didn't. But all those weapons coming at you, powered by mantras, and very, very powerful weapons, and death-inflicting mantras, none of them took hold, because I was sitting on your chariot. And so once Krishna got off the chariot, they took effect. But nobody was on the chariot at that time. So what does that tell you? What can you not overcome when you link up in yoga with the Supreme Personality of Godhead? That's what the Bhagavad Gita is about. How will you empower someone today or tomorrow? Why not start with yourself? What a concept. Okay, thank you very much. Thank you for your kind attention. Questions?
Just about this, or can I ask about something else? I'm curious, that Hare Krishna is it the same as like some of the spiritual gurus that I've seen, like Sai Baba and
different
Muji, these people?
Different than Muji, yeah. Different than Sai Baba.
They chant Hare Krishna, I've heard,
mm-hmm.
It's still different.
Yeah, I mean, to list all the differences and all the levels of difference would take too long.
Yeah, okay.
Prabhupada, whatever any other guru might explain, and levels of God realization, usually they only describe the first level of God realization, which is merging into the oneness, the energy of God, after one dies. So Prabhupada explains all three levels of God realization. So it's far more comprehensive, and this too is explained through Bhagavad Gita, but most of the commentaries and translations of Bhagavad Gita are done by people who don't understand the full scope of what's being said. Whereas I would suggest that Prabhupada is probably the preeminent translator of Bhagavad Gita. And how do we know that? Well, we know that because of the effect it's had in the world. And so there are people in all different countries now who have become devotees of Krishna who were not devotees of Krishna, including Indian people. Indian people all know about Krishna, but they weren't exactly all devotees of Krishna. So, I mean, that's a very simple explanation. It's far more to it than that. Okay. Anybody else? Nope.
Come back to why Arjuna wouldn't fight Star. I mean, he was the world's most eminent warrior. Mm. So, battle would have been a problem to him.
No.
It would have been something he tried.
Well, he's actually had fought.
He was outside. So he wasn't afraid of what was outside him.
Correct.
So, fighting externally was not an issue.
Correct.
But Krishna was trying to explain to him that everything was an illusion, that nothing had any ultimate essence because it's just an imagination.
Mm-hmm.
The quotes about everybody's going to die here, whether you ready
or
stay your hand.
Yeah.
So, was he trying to say that if the battle really starts, and the battle only really begins when it involves your own heart, when it's not only destroying the things you hate or destroying the things that oppose you, but actually destroying the things that you love? Because they were represented by his relations and all the things he do.
Mm-hmm. To transcend all of it. Correct?
He was killing, in essence, he was almost killing himself, his own personality, his idea of who he was.
Well, in the essence of that, he was killing off his attachment to most people. Arjuna's point of view was sentiment. It was sentimentality. And he was using a limited conception of things from his own subjective point of view of what seemed to be the right thing to do versus the wrong thing to do. But there was far more at stake than that, and he was forgetting his duty from that point of view. So Krishna was, the first thing he had to do was enlighten him as to what the full concept, the full point of view was. And then to raise him up to, Krishna could have destroyed them all by himself, but Arjuna got the credit. That's the other thing. Krishna doesn't want the credit for everything. He wants you to have the credit. He wants you to be the conscious person that does whatever it is you do that has a positive effect on the world, a positive outcome. That you will get the recognition. And that's one of the reasons that happened like that. But yeah, no, you're right. You're right.
I have a question. It's paradoxical because when we do something as service, we do it out of our personal ego. So we don't take the cook from it.
If we do it out of ego, yes. But here we do it for God. Everything must be done as an offering to God. That's the ultimate concept. Because we're offering everything we do to God, then we must, but we should do it to the best of our ability.
It says a curse is a benediction.
A curse is a benediction. Negative karma is not exactly negative karma. Oh, it's negative, all right. I'm experiencing it. I'm living it. Don't tell me it's not negative. I'm suffering like anything. the reason, one of the main reasons that you're suffering any kind of negative karma, because inherent in that suffering is a lesson that you need to learn. That evidently you hadn't learned, that's because, and the proof is you're suffering now with it. Because when we learn our lessons, we begin to neutralize the need for negative reaction and subsequent suffering. That begins to fade out of our lives. We become happier, more fulfilled, more enlightened, more empowering of others. So, yeah, difficult karma is difficult. I know. I've been through it. You've been through it. We've all been through it. We'd rather not have it. I'm there. But there is a lesson underlying in every situation like that. So perhaps if we learn the lesson, we don't repeat. Or rather, we're doomed to repeat the lessons we do not learn. That's a historical thing. History repeats itself. We're doomed to repeat the same things we did 20 years ago, 30. Now we're looking at this Celtic Tiger business. Look what they're doing already. Look at property prices now, rent prices. It's like it was 8 years ago or whenever it was. You know, they've already lost the run on themselves.
Is still existing in India and is 2 million years old.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any evidence which took place, the battle took place 5,000 years? Is there any, or did any scientists find any evidence of some relic or something like that in
Kurukshetra?
Yeah.
I haven't heard of any. Does anybody else know? There's evidence of Dwarka. They've discovered Dwarka off the coast of Gujarat, of Dwarka. And they started to investigate those ruins, and then somehow they stopped. You know, the Indian government stopped it. But the evidence is there. And it just says there's evidence of Ram's bridge to Lanka. Can be seen from satellite photographs.
But if we try to externalize that, how is to internalize it, we'd probably be making a big mistake, right? Because it was, regardless of where the battle took place or not, the conversation in Krishna Arjuna is Krishna to you, right?
Yeah.
If we place this as a battle that happened 5,000, 10,000 years ago.
Well, it did happen.
But that's not the point. The point is...
No, it's not the point. You're right.
Here and now. It can't have any benefit to you when you look upon it as some historical...
But some people enjoy that sort of thing. But you're right. But it's a metaphor for us. It's not... This is not a dead text. We're just reading some story. This is a metaphor for your life. And the same kind of problems that you go through, Arjuna goes through from his own point of view. And Krishna helps to resolve those problems in the most enlightening manner you can find anywhere. That's my opinion.
But at the same time, Kurukshetra exists.
Kurukshetra still exists.
You can go there, there's a train station.
You can go there.
I kind of take from your class as well that this kind of empowerment is a sign that you are doing Krishna's will as well. Is there any other symptoms to know that what you're doing in your life that it's actually what Krishna wants you to do?
Well, and then you will begin to reciprocate with Krishna, and he'll appear. He'll appear in so many ways in your life, signs. He'll send things to you, depending what level of consciousness that you're on. The higher your consciousness, the more it becomes. This is not something that's dead or static. It's dynamic. As your consciousness expands, your experience of reciprocation with God also expands. And it becomes more living, more tangible.
Kshatriya died, they're given an opportunity to go to heaven, is that exclusively or they don't know, or do you have to die for a similar reason and they go back to Krishna, or like, I guess you don't have to go to heaven, or...
Well, if they were actually in transcendental consciousness, then they would go to the spiritual world. But the ones that are not even in transcendental consciousness, because they've sacrificed their life, they'll go to the heavenly planets. That's your minimum. That's not that you couldn't go higher, but you know, you'd have to be in that consciousness. That's why Krishna came, to relieve the burden of the earth, of Bhumi, of Mother Earth. Every now and then we get huge destructive disasters, do we not? And a lot of people are removed altogether, very suddenly. And of course, we know they're disasters and we go, oh my goodness. Flip side of that is it may be a cleanse. You know, I don't want to pronounce that on anything, but that's also what can happen. You know, I know, for example, when they had the tsunami a few years ago, 2004. Stephen's Day, wasn't it? 2004. There are parts of Thailand there where you could have children for your sexual enjoyment. And people, of course, go there. Men go there to enjoy children. Well, that place was wiped out. So I'll let you interpret that as you like. I interpret it as a cleanse. Okay. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna. We'd like to thank you, Arun Guru, for this enlightening talk. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.